Keith Bradbury is making a return as a guest speaker today. For those of you who did not hear him the first time, he is Lynn Bradbury's son, who's preached for us several times. So if you would, please help me welcome Keith Bradbury.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Had a little bout with laryngitis earlier this week. Hopefully I will be able to deliver a message this morning, but as long as I don't drop everything in the process. Introduced as the title tune of a 1930s Broadway musical, this tune later appeared in the film Young Frankenstein and revived in 1984. Well, Wilbur, I can name that tune in six notes. Well, Eddie, I can name that tune in four notes. Wilbur, I can name it in three notes. Name that tune. Well, of course, the song is Putting on the Ritz, but the series Name That Tune began as a radio game show in 1952. It gained popularity and moved to television in 1953, and the series ran until 1959, and then had revivals in 1970 and 1974, where it ran until 1981. It came back in 1984 and lasted until 1985, and a new series premiered in 2021 in Australia. Now, one of the most well-known segments was the Bid a Tune segment, where contestants would bid against each other, betting they could name a song in fewer notes than the other contestant. Now, as a child, I remembered watching the show, and I think it caused severe psychological damage to me as a kid, because every time I heard a song come on the radio, I tried to identify it in as few notes as possible, because I thought at some point in my life, I may have to do this in front of a live studio audience. Now, we're not here to talk about game shows or how quickly you can identify a song, but we are going to be talking about Gideon in the book of Judges, and we're going to be talking about a bidding war of a completely different variety. How few men will God select to defeat a vast Midianite army? Now, make your way to Judges chapter 6. We're going to set the stage in the first few verses there of Judges chapter 6, and I'm going to read verses 1 through 10. It says, "The Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight. So the Lord turned them over to Midian for 7 years. The Midianites overwhelmed Israel. Because of Midian, the Israelites made shelters for themselves in the hills, the caves, and the strongholds. And whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the people from the east would attack them. They invaded the land and devoured its crops all the way to Gaza. They left nothing for the Israelites to eat. And they took away the sheep, the oxen, and the donkeys. When they invaded with their cattle and tents, they were as thick as locusts. Neither they nor their camels could be counted. They came to devour the land. Israel was so severely weakened by Midian that the Israelites cried out to the Lord for help. When the Israelites cried out to the Lord for help because of Midian, the Lord sent a prophet to the Israelites. He said to them, 'This is what the Lord of God of Israel said. I brought you up from Egypt and took you out of that place of slavery. I rescued you from Egypt's power and from the power of all who oppressed you. I drove them out before you and gave their land to you. I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are now living, but you have disobeyed me.'" Now, I want you to ask yourself a couple questions. At what point are you lost? Well, that's kind of a tough question, isn't it? Now, let me ask you another question that sounds similar, but that's actually quite different. At what point do you realize you're lost? Now, see, you're lost the moment you took a wrong turn and didn't realize you went the wrong way. But you may take a long time before you realize you're lost. Bugs Bunny always knew he should have taken that left turn at Albuquerque, right? Now, God turned Israel over to Midian for 7 years. And one of the reasons is it takes time before we realize we're lost. You know, I'm sure like the first year, it was just annoying what the Midianites were doing. But we've got some things stored up. We can make it through this. At some point, they're going to go away, right? But then it just gets worse and worse and worse. You know what it's like. You're driving in a certain direction, vaguely aware of which direction you want to go. You think sooner or later, something will look familiar. Somewhere I'll see a sign, but eventually panic sets in. You realize you have no clue where you're at. Now, I saw a sign a couple weeks ago, and it said something very profound, and I want you to listen to this. Everything happens for a reason. One of those reasons is you're stupid and you make bad decisions. Now, there's a lot of wisdom in that, right? Now, a lot of us are like Israel. We're like Israel. We've been given every blessing. We were given a peaceful life, loving parents, a stable upbringing. And like the prodigal son, you gave it all up, headed off to do things your way. And eventually, you end up swimming in the swill, wishing you'd done things a little differently. Now, if you've been blessed, can I make a suggestion? Start by just praising God, because those blessings are from God, and give Him the glory, because those blessings make other people jealous. And if God removes His protection, the locust may come and carry off every blessing God afforded to you. For Israel, the locusts were the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the people of the east. They took everything. They took the crops. They took the animals. Whatever they wanted, they carried it off with them. Things got so bad that the people finally realized they need help, and they cried out to God. And at this point, a prophet turns up to inform them they are lost. And there's a very interesting thing that's going on here. Because spiritually, they had wandered away from God. And what's happening around you physically with Midian, that is just nothing compared to where they are spiritually. Hell is eternal separation from God. And you're so focused on the here and now that you cannot even comprehend eternity. So God had to make it a little bit more difficult on their lives so they'd realize the spiritual situation they were in. Most of us are like that, where we think as long as everything is going well with my physical life, everything must be okay spiritually. We never reflect where we are, that maybe we are lost. Judges 6, verses 11 through 16 says this, "The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak tree at Ophrah, owned by Joash the Abizrite. He arrived while Joash's son Gideon was there threshing wheat in a winepress so he could hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared and said to him, 'The Lord is with you, courageous warrior.' Gideon said to him, 'Pardon me, but if the Lord is with us, why has such a disaster overtaken us? Where are all his miraculous deeds our ancestors told us about?' They said, 'Did not the Lord himself bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and handed us over to Midian.' Then the Lord himself turned to him and said, 'You have the strength. Deliver Israel from the power of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?' Gideon said to him, 'But Lord, how can I deliver Israel? I mean, just look, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the youngest in my family.' The Lord said to him, 'Ah, but I will be with you. You will strike down the whole Midianite army.'" How many of us go through life, "I want God to do something," and then God comes along and says, "Hello, strong warrior, I've chosen you." That's kind of what God does here. He's going to do something, and it's going to be through you. Anything great God wants you to do will always look impossible from your perspective. Gideon just looked at his own situation. He's a young man. He's not very old. He's from a small tribe. He doesn't have much weight. Just a few minutes ago, he's there hiding in a wine press, which was kind of a round cylindrical structure with a little bit of a wall. And he was probably in there threshing the wheat, trying to duck down a little bit so that when the wind would come by and blow the chaff, hopefully no one would see what he was doing and take away the wheat he was working on. He's like, "I don't have the strength. I don't have the position. I have nothing." But here's an interesting thing. There's a lot of things God could have said to Gideon in this passage, right? He could have corrected Gideon and said, "My people have wandered away from me. This is what happens when you disobey." He could have said that. He didn't, but he could have said that. He could have said, "You've only had it hard for 7 years. The Israelites in Egypt had to wait 80 years from the time Pharaoh killed the infant boys to the first miracle in their deliverance. You haven't experienced anything yet. We lack perspective. We want it now. Remember the character Veruca Salt from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory? I want a ball, I want a party, pink macaroons and million balloons and performing baboons, and give it to me right now. I want the world, I want the whole world. I want to lock it all up in my pocket. It's my bar of chocolate. Give it to me now. I want today. I want tomorrow. I want to wear them like braids in my hair, and I don't want to share them. I want a party room full of laughter, 10,000 tons of ice cream, and if I don't get the things I'm after, I'm going to scream. I want the works. I want the whole works, presents and prizes and sweets and surprises of all shapes and sizes. And now, don't care how, I want it now. Now, God circumvents the entire discussion and says, you can do it. Are you ready? But before God is going to allow Gideon to take down the Midianite oppressors, he's got to take care of something a little bit closer at home first. And this is where we go to Judges chapter 6, verse 25, and it says this: that night the Lord said to him, take the bull from your father's herd as well as the second bull, one that is 7 years old. Pull down your father's Baal altar and cut down the nearby Asherah pole. Then build an altar for the Lord your God on the top of the stronghold according to the proper pattern. Take the second bull and offer it as a burnt sacrifice on the wood from the Asherah pole that you cut down. So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did just as the Lord had told him. But he was too afraid of his father's family and the men of the city to do it in broad daylight, so he waited until nighttime. When the men of the city got up the next morning, they saw the Baal altar pulled down, and nearby the Asherah pole had been cut down, and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. And they said to one another, who did this? And they investigated the matter thoroughly and concluded that Gideon, son of Joash, had done it. The men of the city said to Joash, bring out your son so we can execute him. He pulled down the Baal altar and cut down the nearby Asherah pole. But Joash said to him, to all those who confronted him, must you fight Baal's battles for him? Must you rescue him? Whoever takes up his cause will die by morning. If he really is a god, let him fight his own battles. After all, it was his altar that was pulled down. And that very day, Gideon's father named him Jerubbaal, because he had said to him, let Baal fight with him, for it was his altar that was pulled down. Don't you find it odd? Now, just look at this in context. That Gideon questioned why God had abandoned them, and his own father has an altar to Baal in his property. Isn't that kind of a clueless situation for Gideon to not realize really where they had fallen, how they had turned to other gods? It didn't enter his mind that, wait, we were the ones who put up the Baal altar on our property that all the town came around to worship Baal. And we're wondering why God has abandoned us. It didn't cross his mind, and I always found that a little bit ironic in that passage. I think the way Gideon talks about the God of Israel, I'm pretty convinced that the people have not totally dropped the worship of the one true God. They've just added other regional gods to the mix. Because it's always easy to add other gods when our God isn't moving quite as fast as we think he should. See, before you can be God's chosen instrument, you've got to get rid of the idols and the false gods you bring around to fill your empty life because the real God doesn't act fast enough are usually something a little more difficult to identify than an altar to Baal out in the backyard. Your cell phone is a poor god. Alcohol and drugs are poor gods. Google and social media are poor gods. Sexual deviancy is a poor god. The pursuit of education above all else is a poor god. The pursuit of money above all else is a poor god. Toys, games, cars, possessions are all poor gods. Gossip and titillating news is a poor god. Fame is a poor god. What is your obsession? What is the one thing you simply cannot let go? There is one God, and he doesn't share the throne. Now, to Gideon's credit in this passage, he obeys. He didn't talk back or say, I can't do that. That's my dad's Baal altar. How can I go do that? No, he actually obeys. He does what God tells him. Most of us, when confronted with our own idolatry, make excuses. Got it under control. It's not that bad. God understands. Other people are far worse. At least I haven't killed anybody. You always drop back to that one. At least I haven't killed anybody. But most of us would fall to our knees and cry if we knew the incredible things God was willing to do through us or even bless us with if we just let go of those false gods. If we just let them go. So now that Gideon has been obedient, he's gotten rid of the false gods, he's ready to gather up his army, he sends out messengers and people respond to the call. Meanwhile, a Midian army of more than 130,000 well-armed soldiers, they got camels, they've got provisions, they crossed the Jordan River and they were camped in the Jezreel Valley. Now after the call went out, 32,000 men of Israel rallied to Gideon's call. Well, that's a lot of guys, but there's 130,000 down in the valley. God looks at the numbers and said, "You got way too many men for me to give you the victory." Sure, God could defeat that army with 32,000, but Gideon and Israel might think that somehow they did it by their own hand. So God tells Gideon, "Say to the men, if any man is shaking in fear, they can turn around and go home." 22,000, just up and leave, right there on the spot. Hey, there's 130,000 of them, 32,000 of us. Billy Bob said we're going to get together and we're going to overthrow the invading government, but this doesn't look so good. We're heading home, guys. Bye. We'll see you later. I don't like those odds. You know, sometimes in churches we have big crowd events, right? You get a contemporary Christian artist in, or you get one of the guys from Duck Dynasty. Suddenly you got a huge crowd, and the next week they're gone. And a lot of times the people who are regulars in the church feel like, wow, that was a mountaintop experience, but then just kind of settles back down into, oh, we're still us. We're still normal. And sometimes there's a little bit of depression that sets in because there's no real commitment to see things beyond just what's going on around us. Oh, there's a big show. Let's see how many people turn up. Oh, it wasn't as many as I thought. I'll see you guys later, and we'll head on off. I believe there's a reason God told those afraid to leave first. Cowardly people impede God's will. And this is an important thing to remember. Cowardly people impede God's will. God wants to do great things. Cowardly people say it can't be done. God even goes so far as to condemn cowardice in Revelation 21:8. He includes the cowardly with the sexual immoral, the idolaters in combination when he says, "But as for the cowards, unbelievers, detestable persons, murderers, the sexually immoral, and those who practice magic spells, idol worshipers, and all those who lie, their place will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur. That is the second death." There's a lesson here, and Jesus made a very clear point, testified to it in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life because of me will find it. Jesus calls us to love him first and to trust him more than we love our own life or trust our own judgment. I don't know if you've heard this story about a recent story about a Tennessee preacher named Robert Galati. He spent a year having regular quiet times with God that frequently lasted for 2 hours. He was going through a very difficult time in his ministry. He was going through a lot of frustrations, you know, and he talked about his prayer life at that time. He was like, "God, I need you to fix my elders. I need you to fix my deacons. I need you to fix these people in my church because things aren't going right." He went through a really difficult time because two of his friends in the ministry, Jared Wilson and Darren Patrick, both committed suicide less than a year apart. He started to realize that he and other preachers like him were totally relying upon their own strength and not upon God. He decided to trust God and not his own efforts. He said God really started to move through his prayer time. Goliath said when he first began, you know, he was asking God to do things, but then it was always somebody else, never himself. And at some point, God revealed to him that God wants Goliath to focus on him, because when we enter into prayer with God, it's about correcting ourselves first so we can enter into his presence. God convinced Gileadi that he had the issues of pride, arrogance, and jealousy. Gileadi became convinced he needed to pray for the ministries of the churches around him, because God opened up into his prayer life that he wasn't lifting up any of the churches around him. It was always about him and his needs. And he wanted to be great in his ministry and congregation. 10 months into praying, Gileadi said he heard the word spontaneous baptisms, and he had no clue what it meant. And the next Sunday, the COVID-19 scare kicked in, and the church had its lowest Sunday attendance in the years he had ever been there. But that Sunday, 99 people came forward and were baptized. And over the next 4 months, more than 1,000 people were baptized. Now see, church isn't a place for the unrepentant cowardly, and we're not put here to play it safe. And I was amazed at how this preacher's story paralleled the Gideon story, and I want that to be our story too. So after God has thinned the ranks and gotten rid of the cowardly, he still thinks the numbers are too great. He tells the men to go to the water and drink, and keep only the men who drink by lifting the water to their mouths. Send everyone else who laps the water like a dog on their hands and knees home. Only 300 men lift the water to their mouths. The other 9,700 were sent home. Now, I've read commentaries where authors have suggested that those who brought the water to their lips were being more attentive than those who lapped the water like a dog. And perhaps that's true. But in spectacular Name That Tune fashion, God tells Gideon he can defeat the Midian army with only 300 men. And that's the exciting part of this passage here. Now, I don't want to blow by this attentive possibility here, because Jesus tells us we are to be attentive. The parable of the wise and foolish virgins, Jesus says that his followers must be ready and watchful for his return. There are other things that we are to be instructed to be attentive to. We are to be attentive to the schemes of Satan so we do not fall into his traps. We are to be attentive to the needs of our brothers and sisters. We are to be attentive to our own sin and rid ourselves of it. We are to be attentive to the sins of others and try to rescue them whenever possible. It's very possible God was identifying those who lapped the water like dogs as people who were only concerned with their own momentary thirst versus those who brought the water to their mouths, always minded their surroundings, waiting for the opportunity because at any moment they could go into battle. It's very possible. We know it's down to 300 now, and in Judges chapter 7, verses 9 through 14, that night the Lord said to Gideon, "Get up, attack the camp, I'm handing it over to you." Now, remember, 300 people, 130,000 troops. "But if you are afraid to attack, go down to the camp with Purah your servant and listen to what they are saying. Then you will be brave and attack the camp." So he went down. So in other words, he was afraid. He was afraid. It's okay to be afraid, okay? Fear and cowardice are two totally separate things. We can always be afraid, but he's not a coward here, because he's going down there and he's going to listen in. He went down with Purah the servant to where the sentries were guarding the camp. "Now the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the people from the east covered the valley like a swarm of locusts. Their camels could not be counted. They were as innumerable as the sand on the seashore. And when Gideon arrived, he heard a man telling another man about a dream he had. The man said, 'Look, I had a dream. I saw a stale cake of barley rolling down into the Midian camp, and it hit a tent so hard it knocked it over and turned it upside down. The tent just collapsed.' The other man said, 'Without a doubt, this symbolizes the sword of Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite. God is handing Midian and all the army over to him.'" Now, I'm sure they didn't realize the numbers had been whittled down to 300 when they said that. Otherwise, they probably would have felt really foolish. "What, there's only 300 people that are coming? We're going to destroy them." But we discount what God is doing in the background, don't we? That's the important thing to realize. We think that with 300 men, we can't do God's will. But we discount what God has already been doing in the background, setting the fear in the hearts of the Midianites. Even when you think you're in over your head, never discount what God is doing. In 1999, I was preaching in southern Indiana at a small church in a town where I completely lost count of the number of funerals I performed. 1 year, it was over 20 over the winter months. I mean, I was doing funerals and nothing but funerals. It was a very depressing situation, to be honest. But it was during church camp I met a man named Harvey Wadlow. And he invited me to move my family up to Indianapolis and work with Missions Alive. Thing is, I would have to raise my own support. You know, they weren't going to pay for it. I'd just have to do it all on my own. In our small church in southern Indiana, I was living in a parsonage. I didn't have any money saved up. I had very little income, but I didn't have a house payment because I was living in a parsonage. Now, if I moved to Indianapolis, I'd have to buy a place with money I didn't have, and I'd have to provide for myself because I'd be working with a mission that wasn't paying for me. I would just have to raise my own support. It was a very, you know, it was one of those situations where, like, how would you make a decision like that? If we moved, we wouldn't have anything. But it was something we really wanted to do. And we were also expecting at that time our second child. So we were going to be expecting a second child if we moved, and this would all happen all at once. But my wife and I decided to pray, and we laid it out before God, and we said, look, God, if you give us 6 months of support, we'll make the move. And within a week, Harvey called us and said a man from Cincinnati was willing to give us 6 months of support to help bring us to Missions Alive. So we made the move and been here in Indianapolis ever since, and at no time have we ever been in a situation where God has not provided. We just obeyed the call and moved. Now, sometimes we don't understand what God is doing in the background, but it's out of our hands. We put it in His, and we follow obediently. God worked behind the scenes to direct us here, where we've worked with a mission, had a ministry, filled the pulpits of various churches part-time. We also met Toby and Amy Hill, a missionary family who we've supported financially on a monthly basis for quite a few years. And we were able to send our children to Kingsway Christian School, which has been a benefit to both the family and to them and their education. I think there's so many things God has done for us as a family because we made the decision to put our faith and trust in Him. But let's get back in here to Gideon in chapter 7. Verse 15 says, when Gideon heard the report of the dream and its interpretation, he praised God. Then he went back to the Israelite camp and said, get up, for the Lord is handing the Midianite army over to you. He divided the 300 men into three units. He gave them all trumpets and empty jars with torches inside. And he said to them, watch me and do as I do. Watch closely. I'm going to the edge of the camp. Do as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, you also blow your trumpets all around the camp, then say, for the Lord and for Gideon. And Gideon took 100 men to the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just after they had changed guards. They blew their trumpets. They broke their jars they were carrying. All three units blew their trumpets and broke their jars at the same time. They held the torches in their left hand and the trumpets in their right. Then they yelled, a sword for the Lord and Gideon. And they stood in order all around the camp. The whole Midianite army ran away. They shouted as they scrambled away. When the 300 men blew their trumpets, the Lord caused the Midianites to attack one another with their swords throughout the camp. The army fled to Bethshitta on the way to Zerara, and they went to the border of Abel Meholah near Tabath. And it's really hard to say names when your voice doesn't work half the way anyway. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh answered the call and chased the Midianites. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen any of those prank videos. I did watch some of them on YouTube, where somebody wakes somebody up while they're dead asleep on the couch with a loud noise or something like that. They scream out like that. But that's what happened, is that they were surrounding the camp, and they were blowing trumpets, and they suddenly broke their jars, and suddenly lights were everywhere. And you know what it's like when you're suddenly woken up, and there's lights everywhere, and you're not sure what's going on, you're disoriented. And they just started hacking and slashing away at each other, hurting their own ranks, and then they ran. The Midianites ran for their lives. And one of the interesting things about this passage is, I love how it ends, because the victory of Gideon doesn't end with just him, but others get on board as well. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh answered the call and chased the Midianites. And when you are faithful, when you put your trust in the Lord and carry out His plans, others will rise to join you. Now, it won't happen while they think you're going to fail, but as soon as victory is within grasp, you'll see people rise up and join you. And that's kind of what happened here. That's what puts the naysayers to rest, is when God gives you the victory. Sometimes you have to push through the naysayers to be obedient to the Lord.
But all who put their trust in the Lord will not be put to shame. John 16:33 says this, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In the world you have trouble and suffering, but take courage. I have conquered the world. Jesus has already conquered the world. He's already given us a message. You have a Bible. He's already given you his Holy Spirit. He's ready to tell you, go, faithful warrior. You can succeed. So many of us think that, well, we come up with the excuses. I'm not strong enough. I'm not famous enough. I'm not handsome enough. I'm not pretty enough. Or, I'm too pretty. No one will take me seriously. No, none of you will ever say that. Well, Tom might, but no. But, you know, that we always come up with excuses, but God says, I have put my spirit in you. You can do it. And that's what we've got to realize today, is that God has put his spirit in us, and he's called us to be part of his great conquest of this world, bringing it all under Jesus, bringing salvation to all who will come. We're going to have the hymn of invitation right now. So I'd ask the singers to come forward right now as we get ready to sing that. But I want you to reflect where you're at. Have you been afraid? Have you been the frightened warrior? You want to do God's will, but you're not really sure what he wants you to do. Let me encourage you, start your day asking that question, God, what do you want me to do today? And as we sing this hymn of invitation, if you'd like to come forward, we'll offer that up to you right now to come forward, and we'll be happy to pray with you and talk with you.